Now, I have a condition called tinnitus, and there we are. I have a condition called tinnitus, and some of you probably have it too, ringing in the ears. I've had it since I was 20-something, and I don't know why. It's not really gotten worse over time. It's constant. I can hear it right now, and I can so far still kind of ignore it most of the time, but it's there. Sometimes, if someone has had too much aspirin, a side effect can be tinnitus. That wasn't the case with me. It's just there. For some people, it is so loud that they can hardly hear conversation, but thank goodness that's not the case for me. So it is a constant companion in my life. And so imagine my surprise when one day, many years ago, when I was practicing meditation, and I emphasize the word practicing, and was actually quite new at it, this happened. The meditation, I was reading a book by Lawrence Lushan called simply How to Meditate. And it was just one technique after another, after another, after another. And so I was trying them all out. And this one was, it's a kind of mindfulness meditation, and it is where you focus on separating your observing self from your constant flow of mental thoughts and flotsam and jetsam. And he gave the image of imagining yourself sitting in the back of a theater while you watch the screen of your mind. And that seemed, I love movies. I thought that might work. So, brand new neophyte meditator, and first time I ever tried this technique. I'm sitting there quietly, and lo and behold, I do feel myself pull back from my mind, and I'm aware of my thoughts going along out there. But what I also realize is that the ringing in my ears was gone. And it wasn't just that I was ignoring it, which I can do. I actually, and this all happened in a split second, of course, right? I actually listened for it, realized it was gone, and then, of course, broke the meditation and it came back and I was back in my mind again. Tinnitus is a neurological condition. My brain does it all the time, whatever it is. But in this meditative state, I was someplace else. And I mean in my brain. But I was someplace else where the tinnitus didn't exist. Well, I was practicing medicine at the time, and I told a friend of mine about this, and he said, "Well, you were probably in a state of self-hypnosis," as though that explained everything. But I'll tell you also that I was actually at a excuse me, a training course for hypnotherapy. You had to be a therapist of, counselor of some kind. And this was an introductory training in hypnotherapy, and I was curious about whether I wanted to do this. And the trainers were a pair of men. I was sitting near the front, and they said at one point that one of the men would self-hypnotize there in front of us so that when the other stuck a pin through the back of his skin, in and out, he wouldn't flinch. And he kept talking, and the fellow stuck a pin through his hand, and it didn't look like he felt a thing. But he said, "Further, when my friend takes the pin out, I'm not going to bleed." And he took the pin out, the other fellow took the pin out, and there was not a drop of blood. Now, I was up close. I didn't see this being a trick. It looked like something inexplicable that they were calling self-hypnosis. I don't know what that was. I don't know what was happening there. It wasn't a magic show, that's for sure. So, without that experience of having my tinnitus disappear while I was meditating, I doubt I'd even have the thought, let alone the courage, to try to talk today about body, mind, and spirit, one of the greatest philosophical topics, and I'm not a philosopher. I almost called it body, mind, and spirit for dummies. at least for this dummy anyway. So let's give it a try. Let's begin with the relationship most often talked about over long centuries, that between the mind and the body. We'll look back to Plato and Descartes and then consider some modern ideas. So many Greek philosophers, in particular Plato, conceived of the body and the mind as essentially different, distinct, but connected somehow, probably only temporarily. The body, clearly, is of this material world. The body is passing and changeable. It's part of the perishing world of matter. The mind, however, in Plato's ideas, is from the world of forms, and that was sort of a technical term that he created to talk about the eternal, unchanging, and perfect world of ideas and concepts. The mind lived in that world, or comes from that world. So an example is that if you think of a table, you can think of a table, or you can sit at a table. And the conceptual table that you think of, you can visualize it as perfect or imagine it as a perfect table. But the real table almost undoubtedly has some kind of flaws. So this basic understanding of material world and world of forms, concepts, ideas, that has been labeled dualism as a philosophical term. And because two very separate existences are being proposed. And so I'll just underline dualism, because we'll come back to that idea. The mind concepts perfection side and the body facts imperfection side. Not that I was indicating that perfection is there and imperfection is here, but just worked out that way. So then we jump to René Descartes, the French philosopher and mathematician from the 17th century, and he took a similar dualist position. He's the guy that said, I think, therefore I am. He reasoned that thinking alone establishes existence and that mental function is essentially different from bodily function. For instance, his argument was that thought is limitless, but the body is finite. The body can be dismembered, torn apart, cut in pieces, but the mind can't be. Descartes got the big ball rolling with that argument, and it has stayed a hot topic ever since. And there's a lot of different variations of this, but the one that I want to point out to you is something called property dualism, because it proposes that the mind is a grouping or a cooperation of independent properties that emerge from the physical brain, but that cannot be reduced to the physical brain. In other words, the sum is greater than the parts. And that's property dualism. And I mention it because I think that liberal religious theology and thinking and science might come together in this idea of property dualism. So that's enough about dualism for right now. The opposing side to dualism is what's called monism, or one thing only, the principle that everything is really part of one essential thing. Now, physics, for instance, says everything is energy. Even matter is energy. It's just in a different form, light, heat. All of it is energy. In esoteric religion, everything is seen as universal mind or spirit, and perhaps the material world is just an illusion or a dream within the mind. So both of these are monist ideas. But the prevailing idea in both science and philosophy is that mind is really just a manifestation of the body, not a separate thing. So I guess we could call this physical monism, in that it's monism based on physics. There are many questions left, though, perhaps never to be answered. Subjectivity, for instance. Now, that subjectivity isn't yet measurable by brain studies. We know the neural pathways that should have taken the pain sensation from the skin of that hypnotherapist to his brain. And if his brain was actually reacting to the pain, then a scan could measure the blood flow in the right area that shows that the brain is picking up the impulses. But what was he controlling? Was he controlling his brain's blood flow so that, in fact, that part of the brain didn't get triggered? We have no idea how that would happen if that's what he was doing. Not to mention if what he was doing, not to mention that something he did stopped the blood flow. I mean, we have no idea how that could happen either. And similarly, although we know what brain area is activated when I raise my hand, we have no idea where or how the action appears in my brain. We know where the motion center is, but not the idea center that said, raise my hand. We don't know where intention arises in the brain. And further, there's no scientific explanation as yet for how choice operates. Right at this moment, some of you may be choosing to listen or choosing not to listen. You're free to do that, but I have no idea what you're doing when you make the choice. Nobody does. So I suggest that although we might come to determine how the brain does these things, the answer to why I do this or you do that at any given moment, in other words, an explanation for subjectivity, will at best be in the realm of property dualism, where the sum is greater than the parts. A number of evidentiary pieces might fit together, but they won't be able to explain the whole thing. That's my suggestion for how this is going to go in the future. And that's body and mind. Now, the second side of this triangular subject is body and spirit. And be patient with me if I don't define spirit just at the moment. Many of you will by now be familiar with the story of Jill Bolte Taylor. You might have seen her on YouTube or on a television talk show or read her book. She is a neuroanatomist, a research neurologist who had a stroke. And Taylor may have been a pretty ordinary neuroanatomist, but her stroke wasn't at all ordinary. For one thing, it evolved over 4 hours of fluctuating symptoms, such that she could consciously experience it from moment to moment. It wasn't like stroke, unconsciousness. She had a variable state of consciousness as her stroke came on. And for the other, it was a dominant hemisphere stroke, left side stroke. For most people, left side stroke. Occurring to a trained scientific observer who, when able to, during this very serious illness and even in her long recovery, knew something about what was happening in her brain. So you can find her extraordinary talk about this on TED Talks online. I can tell you more about that if you were curious. Or you can borrow her book, My Stroke of Insight, which is in every library, I'm sure, by now. Now, in a nutshell, Taylor's dominant hemisphere was gradually shut down by a brain hemorrhage. And this left her awareness limited to the non-dominant side, which is usually the right half of the brain. And the non-dominant side is the seat of emotional awareness, imagery, intuition, and lots of other things. But it doesn't measure or calculate. Most of the time, the loud, non-dominant, verbal, calculating, numerical left brain is what we are aware of, and it's busily constructing reality in a left brain way through definitions and separating distinctive principles. The left brain says, if this is A, that's B. or don't do that, do this, or this is me, that isn't me. And it drowns out our right brain most of the time. But for Taylor, with only her non-dominant brain functioning, she was left with a profound, intuitive, non-verbal experience of the world that was, at the time, ecstatic and visionary for her. Herself was unlimited by boundaries. She couldn't tell where her own being stopped and where the universe began. And you'll hear meditating, people who meditate sometimes describe that as well. She couldn't perceive her, She had that, therefore, a sense of oneness with everything in this as her stroke progressed. Learned things like numbers and letters became simply design elements, you know, that she thought, oh, that, you know, looking at a five and, oh, look at how that's put together. They were meaningless in themselves to her, but part of the wonder of this newly experienced world. And this was accompanied with, as I said, ecstasy, but also with peace and a universal sense of being. And later in the hospital, when she couldn't tell one person from another, because that's left brain stuff, you're you and you're you, she could tell how you seem to feel or come across, and how you seem to feel or come across. And that was her right brain distinguishing between something essential or emotional and something else essential or emotional. It took her 8 years to recover from this stroke, getting back speech and movement. And she came to understand during that first experience and the whole time that we are not our dominant hemispheres, although we usually think we are. One of the wonders, though, that I haven't heard Taylor address is that she had a functioning consciousness at all with only half her brain. What does that say about where consciousness is in the brain? Because the way we experience the world makes us think that consciousness is in the left brain, or, you know, it's very determined. But she had consciousness with only half her brain. That, to me, is just amazing. Now, guess where we Unitarian Universalists tend to live in our brains? We're often enraptured by our ability to articulate ideas. But we also have life and being on the other side of our brain, where we feel part of a grand whole in which all is one and at peace. And some of us perceive that more than others. Some of us are skeptical about that aspect, but we all have it. It's there in our brains. Now, let me point out that the non-dominant brain and its functions are as real as the dominant brain and its functions. And therefore, the non-dominant brain must be as necessary as the dominant part. It has to be there for some reason. And if it evolved to be what it is, then I say it had evolutionary purpose, which some would translate into survival value. I like the other idea of evolutionary purpose rather than just survival. You know? It's not just an appendix, and it can't be dismissed as imagination or meaningless hooey. But if you are a rationalist who wants things to be well-grounded in the material world, then perhaps you might be open to a definition of spirit that involves the ability or the preference to be aware of the non-dominant experience of the world, the non-dominant brain, at least some of the time. That's as material as saying, you know, I go to the angels, which is, you know, that's an image of some experience, But it's harder to imagine for a rationalist than I go to my non-dominant brain. There's nothing supernatural about saying I have right brain experiences. I seek them. Perhaps meditation is, I'm going to say a series of speculations here. Perhaps meditation equalizes hemispheric brain function so that you're feeling both sides of your brain at once, or even perhaps preferentially the non-dominant. And perhaps prayer is reaching out from the dominant side to the non-dominant side. Now think about that as a definition of prayer. It doesn't mean that the non-dominant side doesn't go past the non-dominant side, but for a rationalist, prayer might be simply reaching across your own brain to find out what is there on the other side that might lead you, guide you, elevate you. William Blake talks about, and it's in our hymn book, he writes of praying to the mercy, pity, peace, and love within the human heart, which I think is, it's one of the reasons we can even use the word prayer as Unitarians. But maybe what Blake was referring to, mercy, peace, pity, love, maybe those are non-dominant brain effects or experiences. So when we wonder what the difference is between mind and spirit, we need to be clear which mind we're thinking of. The rational brain of the rational mind of the dominant brain, or the holistic mind of the other side. Perhaps spirit is the holistic mind, the right brain mind. Now, why are some people more spiritual than others? Or why are some drawn to and in touch with their non-dominant functions more easily than others? Well, believe it or not, genetic research has found, at least one study anyway, found that at least that one reason might lie in a single molecular difference in one gene. That having one, I assume it's one of the nucleic acids, having one nucleic acid in that spot or another makes you either spiritual or not spiritual. I find that a little scary, actually, to think that it's that simple. But there was evidence found that it could be that. Which, of course, reiterates that spiritual might be physical. Another way for rationalists to enter the idea of the world of spirit. And no doubt there are other numerous brain differences that relate to spirituality as well. But in that case, it was just one molecule difference. But let's not make the mistake that I'm going to say hyper-materialists, and you'll see what I mean in a second. Let's not make the mistake that hyper-materialists do. Wilder Penfield poked electrodes into the brain, and people said they smelled coffee or toast or heard a piece of music. Now, Penfield didn't go on to say that there's no such thing as coffee or toast or music. It was just that stimulating the brain made you think of coffee or toast or music. And just because brain flow can be measured during an ecstatic sense of union with the divine, which has been done, doesn't mean that the brain and its blood flow is creating that ecstatic sense of union. Just because temporal lobe epilepsy can cause mystical experiences doesn't mean that all mystics have epilepsy. Rather, it could just possibly be that these parts of the brain are our hyperlink to something that is beyond, something that is spiritual in the more woo-woo sense of the word. Just possibly, we have receptors for spirit. And we so often hear arguments that devalue spirit on material grounds that we might forget to think about this with an open mind. But in fact, if spirituality could be grounded in the body, or in fact reflected in or perceived by the body, I've lost my place here. If in fact spirituality could be grounded or reflected in the body, the material world, what the body is, the material world, I've got to start this all over again. If in fact spirituality could be grounded or reflected in the body, which is of the material world, what evolutionary purpose does it have in the material world? It has to have one, or it wouldn't be there. That's evolutionary theory. One thought is that our big brains and intelligence make us able to foresee our non-existence. And perhaps for the vast majority of people, especially in history, but also today, spirituality makes a limited lifespan more tolerable and meaningful. And not in a way that's immature, but rather one that's deeply embedded in our evolutionary process. Given the unifying sense that the non-dominant brain experiences, spirituality could be one of the most basic means of uniting us, bringing us together into larger groups that help our survival. And the spiritual impulse might be built into our society as a stabilizing force, giving a larger sense of self and family and relatedness. Perhaps religion is the dominant brain's participation in spirituality. What do you believe? Where do you go to church? That's dominant brain. Those are dominant brain questions. Despite the violence that has been done in the guise of religion, it's quite easy to see that religion within even complex societies and empires has usually been a unifying factor, if you look at all of history, and frequently a source of peace. Religion seems to be more prone to violence on the boundaries of a society or in the boundaries of a religion, where the hard definitions of the dominant brain insist on establishing dominant power. But away from those boundaries, spirituality and religion may well be a huge unifying force in humankind. In liberal theology, spirituality and religion are seen through the lens of the body and direct experience. What I'm getting at is that if we start with the probability that spirit is embodied, then the positive value and function of spirit and its reflection in organized religion must also be embodied. And this makes reverence, for instance, a bodily function. Now imagine that. If such ideas might help rationalists in our congregations be able to embrace what others think of as spiritual, then maybe we can find a more comfortable and common language of spirit and reverence. Body, mind, spirit. Put the one you prefer at the top of the triangle, but whichever that one is, it brings the other two. May our brains, minds, and spirits, every part of them, wherever they be, ever remain deeply connected each to the others, so that we as differing individuals may also be connected profoundly with each other.